They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
All right. Thank you for listening to Magellan's at the Movies, the podcast you're listening to right now. My name is Elliot Magalhães, Magalhães being the original Portuguese pronunciation of the anglicized Magellan. I'm joined, as always, by my brother, Nathan Magalhães Magellan. It's very hot in Kansas City right now.
Oh no!
There are I've literally just seen that that is a record-breaking 80 degrees in Kansas City right now. That is insane. Somebody get on top of global warming already. But we're not here to talk about that. I don't even know why I mentioned that. Nathan, I have a question for you. We sometimes like to start off with just general questions, sort of teasing out our opinions on movies and the state of movies. And this is a question specifically about your favorite thing, Star Wars.
Mm.
Because I recently had cause to see on YouTube the fight, the lightsaber fight between Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan and Darth Maul. By which I mean Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan are on the same side. They're not fighting each other. They're both fighting Darth Maul. And it got me thinking, because as it so happened, I had recently seen part of the fight between Luke and Vader from Return of the Jedi recently. And it got me thinking about the different sort of approaches that those movies had. And I just wanted to know, as a Star Wars super fan, do you prefer the more flashy, fierce spectacle of the prequel fights, which can sometimes feel a little bit over choreographed, or do you like the more patient, prodding, deliberate fights of the original trilogy, which can seem a little sluggish and tepid? And you don't have to confine yourself to that framework. You could say, oh, I love the prequel fights, and I don't find them over choreographed at all.
That's a really interesting question. And I've got like 9 different overly nerdy responses locked and loaded for this sort of thing. Well, because I've seen the Akira Kurosawa spear fight that is largely influencing the way George Lucas choreographed the sword fights in the original trilogy. And my opinion...
Lucas personally choreographed those?
I don't know about that, but, like, it's very clear that, like, that's the template that he gave to whoever then, like, did the actual work or whatever.
Okay.
You know, he was the artistic mind behind that piece, I would say.
Just to clarify, you're talking about the fight in the Hidden Fortress.
Yes, yeah, I am, yeah. And my opinion on that fight is the same as my opinion on a lot of the fights in the original trilogy, in that it lasts way too long and it's boring. It's not particularly exciting to look at. So I'm not going to pick the original trilogy. I don't think there's any fight that's really fantastic in the original trilogy in terms of a lightsaber fight. In terms of...
Ouch.
Well, you know, if I'm comparing it to, like, the hallway fight scene from Daredevil Season 1, there's no compare it. Like, there's no... They're not great fight scenes. The prequels, I agree, can maybe skew a little bit over-choreographed, but here's the position I'm going to take here, and I'm going to, you know, say this with my whole chest, and I am ready to defend it if anyone emails us and says I'm crazy. I think the best Star Wars fights, and this is universally true throughout all 11 movies, are not the best choreographed, but the ones that have the best, like, music and emotional background to the fight. For my money, the final battle between Obi-Wan and Anakin in Revenge of the Sith is probably my favorite fight scene in the entire series, and it's not because I think them spinning their lightsabers standing 2 feet apart is, like, masterful. It's because the acting, the music, I do think it's kind of a fun multi-phase fight as they go through all the different pieces of this inexplicable lava research facility as it, like, breaks apart. But I think what makes it great is the fact that, right, for me, I've watched 2 movies and then, like, 7 seasons of a TV show watching these two guys grow very, very close to each other. And so the payoff of them fighting and, you know, having to do this thing is really good. And I think even that fight you're mentioning in The Phantom Menace, it's a pretty good fight. It is, you know, flashy, well done. I think in large part, again, the music is kind of carrying you over the edge. The choreography is not so amazing that this fight is incredible, but the fact that Qui-Gon dies at the end, spoilers for Phantom Menace, the music, I think that's what really carries it. And then even into the sequel trilogy, I think probably my favorite fight from the sequels is probably gonna have to be the fight between Rey and Kylo at the very end of Force Awakens, just because I think it's, well, I think that's probably one of the better choreographed ones, just in terms of, like, I think it does a very good job of showcasing that Rey doesn't know what's happening, and so the way she fights with a lightsaber is not the way other people have fought with a lightsaber. She's kind of swinging it like a club, which I think if you were to pick up a lightsaber for the first time would be not a bad way to use it, because if you use it like a sword, I think you kind of run the risk of chopping your own arm off. But I think in general, the Star Wars fight scenes are not made on their choreography or the excitement of the things. I think they're made on the emotional background and how you feel about the two characters fighting. And I think that's what makes the prequel fights good. That's what makes the original trilogy fight, like Luke and Vader at the end of Empire Strikes Back, not an incredible fight, but the reveal at the end of it is really good. And, you know, that's what would be your positive mindset towards, or at least that's what my positive mindset is towards it. So that's what I think.
Well, that's great. You've actually preempted my follow-up question, which was going to be about what do you think makes for a good lightsaber fight? And I was going to specifically mention music because, of course, John Williams spun up some absolute classics for the many fights. I would actually have to disagree. I think I would prefer the fights in the original trilogy because I do think that the prequel fights can feel a little bit over choreographed, actually a lot bit over choreographed. Like there are certain things that the performers have to do in order to make certain moves work, so it looks like they're cooperating. Which kind of ruins it for me. Also, the fight between Anakin and Obi-Wan is a snore because I am the exact opposite, and I do not care about Obi-Wan and Anakin's relationship because I think it's so poorly developed in the prequels. So I actually do agree with you that the emotional stakes are often what makes, or in this case, breaks a fight. But I think that the emotional stakes between Luke and Vader are actually pretty good in the original trilogy. And then I don't think that sequel trilogy has anything good in terms of lightsaber fights.
Jeez.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But that's
a harsh,
fun,
I think.
Really?
I mean, I just said positive things about their lightsaber fight, so clearly I don't agree that there's nothing positive to be said. I do... We're running a little long here on banter, but I did want to ask if you had seen any of the set photos that have been coming out from the beginning of Christopher Nolan's Odyssey film, that some set photos have come out of...
Haven't we already talked about this?
No, these are, like, unofficial... These are, like, people in... wherever they're filming, just like taking, you know, paparazzi style photos of Tom Holland in costume and stuff.
Oh, I mean, I've seen them. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that Tom Holland is playing Telemachus or Telemachus. Well, yeah. I don't know. That's a weird pick. Honestly, I'm not impressed with Tom Holland as an actor, but we'll see what happens. That doesn't really do a whole lot for me. And I'm sure that the boat that he's on is probably anachronistic, and that probably is a huge deal to some people who were never going to be pleased in the first place. That's right, I said it. That's right.
All right.
We're brave here at Magellan's at the Movies. We say the kinds of things. We say what's on our mind, and we make no apologies.
That's true. We should make an apology real quick here before we jump into the review of this movie, that we are delaying our episode for our best movies of the 80s, the brains behind the podcast decided that we would need another week just to make sure it's the best possible list that we can present you guys with, so we're giving ourselves a little more time for research, for, you know, just the kind of studious, well-documented, historical basis that the Magellans always bring to these lists. So we had to do an extra week just to be sure that we had those. So we do apologize if you were, like, super excited for that and now your weekend's ruined because you're having to listen to a review for Elliot. What movie are we reviewing today? Maybe you can introduce the audience and bring them back in now that we've lost them by not doing what we promised. But... what are we doing? What movie are we reviewing this week?
Nathan, infuriated audience, we are reviewing Crimson Tide. This is a 1995 submarine thriller movie directed by, the name has literally just like flown out of my head.
Tony Scott.
Tony Scott, yes. Ridley Scott's brother, who tragically took his own life not that long ago, right?
I don't know. What? this is news to me.
Really? You didn't know that?
No, I didn't even know he was Ridley Scott's brother until you said it.
Oh, yeah. There you go. So we're all learning things. But Nathan, now you've made me doubt myself. And I'm having to check and make sure that I'm not just, like, saying things. Yes, good lord. He's the younger brother of Ridley Scott.
Oh.
He died in 2012.
Okay.
Anyway, let's get back on track. This is a 1995 submarine action thriller directed by Tony Scott, starring the late Gene Hackman and the very much early Denzel Washington. And it follows a... Denzel Washington is an XO on a nuclear submarine underneath the command of Captain Gene Hackman. I don't remember the characters' names. And they're in the midst of a crisis, a capital C crisis. Pretty much, I think, the exact same crisis that they use in every Call of Duty game where Russian separatists have taken over Russia's nuclear weapons and are threatening to use them. So into this very precarious situation is thrust our main man, Denzel, and his experienced and somewhat, I don't know, volcanic captain. And the sort of crux of the movie is that they get the orders to launch their nukes at Russia, but then they get a fragment of another message. They don't know what it is or what it, it's just like this specific type of message that comes into nuclear submarines to give them important information and orders. So they just know that it's that kind of order. They don't know what it is. And Denzel thinks that it could be, it could be anything. Could be ordering them to stand down. So he wants to delay the launch because, of course, if you launch nukes at Russia and you don't absolutely have to, things are going to get real bad real fast. Whereas Captain Hackman is wanting to just go ahead with it, to not risk delaying and letting the separatists get their shots off by doing a first strike. So the movie it's just about that conflict, and there emerges a kind of civil war on the submarine as different factions vie for control. This is a pretty successful movie. Sorry, I just opened the wrong tab. Pretty successful movie. It did well with critics. It did well with audiences. It did well at the box office. This is a movie that I have wanted to watch for a long time because I thought I had heard about its premise and I thought it sounded pretty cool. Plus, it's got Denzel in it, and I'm a big fan of Denzel. So I just decided that we should watch it while we accumulate more research for the 80s. I watched this over the weekend, and I gotta say, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very good. I thought that it was tense and entertaining, and Denzel and Gene Hackman, that sounds like they're related, Denzel and Gene Hackman. Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman give such good performances. They're just perfect together. I thought it was just a really entertaining, well-made thriller that I found tense and engaging. I have a few niggling little issues with questions of character choices and some of the dialogue, but ultimately, I think that this was a home run for me, honestly. From Mr. Scott. And Nathan, I'm really interested to hear what you think about this movie, so don't keep me in suspense a moment longer. Let me have it.
That's really interesting that this is your first time watching. I thought this was something that you had already seen. I remember a couple of years ago, you were watching like every single Denzel Washington movie. So I thought this was something you had seen then, and then you were like, oh, well, Gene Hackman passed away, so let's revisit it for the podcast. I didn't realize it was both of our first times watching this. Yeah, I had not heard about this movie. I think I've seen it maybe a few times in terms of like just seeing lists of like movies Denzel Washington is in or something like that. But I had not been super familiar with it. We already reviewed on this podcast another submarine movie from the 90s, Hunt for Red October, which I think ended up making our list of the best movie of...
It did.
Okay, yeah. One of our favorite movies from the 90s. So I was very interested to watch another submarine movie just because I think everything that Hunt for Red October does so well... I think it does such a great job of making submarine fights, which are not the most like fast-paced things in the world, very tense and exciting, so I was kind of excited on that score. I think I probably enjoyed it a little less than you, or I enjoyed it for different reasons than you, because it sounds like you found the question of whether or not the characters were doing the right thing to be very tense and exciting. This question of if the fragment of the message that they got was in order to not attack the Russians, or in order to, you know, hey, go ahead, you're fine to shoot a nuke. I think probably one of my biggest issues with the movie is that I don't think there was ever a point in the movie that I really believed the fragment of the message would say anything other than don't attack. Like, there was never a moment where I was like, oh, Ramses could be right. Like, Ramses has a point. It was always like, I can see where Ramses is coming from, but, like, he's clearly way off the handle here and needs to chill. So, I'm excited to talk about the movie, talk about some of the other characters in it. You didn't mention my favorite part of the movie, so I'm going to have to leave you in suspense about what that is. where do you want to start with this one? What do you want to begin our discussion on?
Well, I'm gonna start things off with that, the point of comparison that I think most people are going to be most familiar with, and that being The Hunt for Red October. Because these are both Cold War movies, they're both submarine movies, they both relate to... Wait a second, this isn't a Cold War movie because the Soviet Union... This is about the Russian Federation. Well, they're both about, right, American-Russian...
Yeah.
Relations. Frosty relations.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that comparison is instructive because less because of the similarities and more because of the differences that I saw between these two movies. Because I thought that I would describe Hunt for Red October as like a tense political thriller, whereas Crimson Tide, I think, is a much more straightforward action movie. Or it's more action-y. It's more leaning into thrills and chills, I think, than the, like, steady, slow buildup of international intrigue that is Hunt for Red October. I think Crimson Tide is simpler in its construction. There's definitely fewer characters that you need to keep track of, fewer motivations and alliances and stakes that you need to follow. If I could sum it up, I think that when I watched The Hunt for Red October as a kid, I didn't understand any of it, and I just watched it to get to the submarine fight at the end, right?
Sure.
I think if I had seen Crimson Tide as a kid, I would have understood it better, and I would have enjoyed it more. Which is not at all to get down on the movie. It's just to say that this is a simpler, more immediate kind of movie, which I enjoyed because I liked the movie so much for its sense of pace and urgency and action. Like, there's always something happening in this movie, whether they're sort of dueling with a Russian rebel submarine or they're organizing different... Ramses or Washington Denzel are organizing their forces and try to, and I really enjoyed the kind of ebb and flow in the control of the submarine, especially towards the back end. I thought the climax is really well constructed in terms of just how many things, how many variables there are in how the two characters are countering each other, right? It may surprise you to know, Nathan, that actually my negatives is going to largely reflect what you said about the lack of indication, the movie's failure to convince me that there was a chance that Ramses was in the right. Because what I did enjoy this movie for, I think, is more for the character side than for, like, the plot side. That I thought the characters were cool very well acted and smart. And I just enjoyed watching the ways that they tried to get one up on each other. I thought that the movie was very tightly scripted in that way. That there was always kind of a, even it, when Ramses is kind of, for a bit of the movie, he's kind of a non-issue because he's locked in his cabin. But even then, you have problems with a submarine and unrest amongst the crew that is keeping that tension level high, keeping that keeping me invested, basically. Very much in the same way that I didn't think that Interstellar was going to have, was going to end with all of humanity dying, but I was never less than 100% invested in finding out how they were going to avoid that, because the scenarios they constructed in Interstellar and in Crimson Tide were such that I could not immediately see a way out of them. So it's just the pleasure of watching a smart, cool, capable character figure their way out of problems.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I agree with everything you said in terms of the comparisons between this and The Hunt for Red October. And I would also agree that the best parts of this movie are not in me grappling with the moral question of who's right, Hunter or Ramses. The best part of this movie is the excitement of some of those sequences. I really enjoyed, like you mentioned, when Ramses is locked in his cabin. There's a bunch of other issues that come up, such as the one really exciting and probably one of my favorite sequences in the movie is the missile explodes very close to the submarine, so parts of the submarine start filling up with water, and the rudder is gone, and so the submarine is sinking down below the depth which it's rated for. So they're getting very close to the submarine being crushed and everyone in the submarine dying. And so I thought that was a fantastic sequence that I think is also emblematic of a lot of the other stuff you were talking about, that it's a very compelling and very simply understood characters. That Hunter is great because we get a grasp on his opinion of things, right? Very early on, there's a scene where a bunch of the officers are eating, and it's very clear that Hunter is very intelligent, and he's maybe a bit more of a peace-minded person than Ramses is, that he has read a lot of theory about war that has influenced his opinion on war and his opinion on the usage of nuclear weapons and things like that. And so I thought this scene where the submarine was sinking was a really interesting scene because it required something slightly outside of what Hunter had been shown to do, that Ramses doesn't feel like Hunter can make difficult decisions because he's only involved in theory. So when Hunter has to make the choice to seal off the section of the ship that is filling up with water, despite the fact that there's a possibility that some of the people trapped in that section could escape, he has to make a very utilitarian sort of calculus where he's like, well, if we don't close it, we're all gonna die. And if we close it, only some of us are gonna die. So I thought that was very interesting. And yeah, a lot of the movie works on that sort of thing. Not because I'm ever convinced that the movie is gonna have a sad ending or an ending that really like stuns me to my core, but because the characters are so well done that it's fun to see, you know, classic characters do classic character sort of things. When Webbs decides not to open up the safe, it's fun, even though this has to be like the 50th time I've seen a conflicted character come out, right, making the correct choice or making the choice that the protagonist wants them to make. So, but it's still really well done because the character is well characterized. Apologies that I can't find a better word for it. As well as incredibly well acted. I think my favorite part of the movie, honestly, is Viggo Mortensen and how well he does with his character. Also, can he just, like, make his eye twitch on command? Because there's two times where he's, like, very clearly stressed and his eye starts twitching. And I'm like, he's got to just be doing that, right? Like, there's no way they sat around with a camera until it just happened to do it. And that's crazy. I can't do any amount of acting. So people who could just make their body do crazy things, that's nuts.
I have no idea. I cannot speak to Viggo Mortensen's finer control over the muscles in his face. But I think that what we're very much circling around here is just saying that this is a very meat and potatoes kind of movie, right?
For sure.
Oh, yeah. It's made out of a lot of recognizable ingredients. It's presented in a pretty standard kind of format, but it is well done. Like, people like meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
And the very best a meat and potatoes meal can kind of be is very, very good. Like, obviously, we all like the more creative, the more inventive movies, but we also all have a soft spot for movies like this that are just a simple and that are just about a simple idea very well executed. And yeah, I think that this movie is a simple idea very well executed. And I really liked it's very dramatic, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's skating right up to the brink, I think, sometimes, of being overstated. Like just a few more shots of the guy that in that scene you're talking about, where there's flooding in a part of the submarine, and they need to close the hatch in order to save the rest of the vessel. And there's a guy sort of standing at the hatch waiting for his friends to get out of there before he has to seal them in. And I think that's one of those moments where just like a few more shots of his crying face or a little bit more soaring orchestral music, and I would have been, all right, well, this is like, you're trying too hard. But crucially, I don't think the movie ever crosses that line. And so it just remains a really good and moving sequence. And yes, it is also a really good character moment for Hunter. Thank you for teaching me the names of the characters, by the way. To demonstrate that he does have what it takes to make those hard decisions. And I think that decision is also emblematic of the movie's ultimate simplicity, because I think in a deeper movie, or a movie that was more invested in the interiority of its characters, that decision would have had much farther ranging complications, or like it would have been relitigated and Hunter probably would have talked about it again. But this movie is a lot more functional than that. It's a lot, again, we keep on saying it, it's a lot simpler. And again, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that it works for the movie. And I would like to talk about the characters, because I liked pretty much all of them. I thought that James Gandolfini's character was probably the weakest link for me, just because he was psychopathically excited to start a nuclear war. But I really liked Hunter. I thought he was a great protagonist. He is absolutely your classic leading man. I mean, Denzel, he's just suffused with that leading man energy that classic Hollywood is built on, right? Am I right or am I right?
You know, if Denzel's in the movie, Elliot's gonna wax on and on about how talented he is and how charismatic he is.
Okay.
I don't disagree. I'm just kind of teasing you here.
I know. But yes, it will come as no surprise that I think Denzel is fantastic in this movie. This is not a role like Macbeth, right, where he's leveraging his finer talents. Like, this is a movie that I think Denzel could probably do in his sleep. This is something that's much more in line with what he usually does, but he doesn't do it in his sleep. He gets out there and he puts out his charisma and his charm and that Denzel smile that makes that just makes you feel good about the world and your place in it. And I really liked, I know I'm really going on here, but I really liked the way that he was able to relate to different parts of the crew, even though that sort of touches on my issues with the dialogue. And you could tell that, or I guess it didn't surprise me that to learn that Quentin Tarantino did work on the script of this movie. Because the whole thing about the whole metaphor of like, I'm Kirk, you're Scotty, I need full power, I was like, yeah, that's a little weird. But it is indicative of his ability to connect with the men on a more emotional level than Ramses is willing or able to do. Like, there's a point where Ramses very deliberately says, like, if you don't like this, get off my submarine. Which is obviously not what Hunter has in mind. And also, this is the last thing I say, I promise. I thought that the ultimate confrontation between Hunter and Ramses, when at the very end of the movie, when Ramses and his forces are back on the bridge and he's demanding that Hunter give him the key, and he starts punching him and Hunter doesn't say a word, and then he gets out the key and puts it over his neck. Ooh, that was so cool, dude. I love that. That was such a great character moment. And afterwards, when they just sit down and start talking, I just loved it. I thought it was great.
Yeah, that is interesting that Tarantino did it. That does explain the... Yeah, it's not so out of character that I was like, wow, that's ridiculous. But him mentioning, like, doing a Star Trek metaphor and then them fighting about Jack Kirby's Silver Surfer, those are some, like, classic Tarantino nonsense. That every character in a Tarantino movie is a nerd in the same way Tarantino is a nerd. So they're all, you know, they love comic books, they love pop culture. That explains a lot. Yeah, I agree. Denzel Washington, very talented actor, very talented actor. And I think you also touched on something at some point in your very long-winded speech that I think is very true about this movie and is maybe another kind of negative in my mind, that there's really only like two or three legitimate dialogue sequences in the film, and for the most part the movie leaves behind dialogue and character building in the first half of the movie. As soon as things start going sideways, the movie is full speed ahead towards excitement, mutinies, counter mutinies, and mutiny to the fourth. And I think it is kind of a detriment because I do find these characters interesting, or at least I find the way the characters are interacting in this Cold War, nuclear fear sort of age interesting, that Ramses and his beliefs, and then Hunter and his beliefs. I think it's kind of unfortunate that the movie doesn't give a bit more time, because I think there's only one scene where it feels like Hunter... And it's a good scene because it's noticeably different, where Hunter goes down to talk to Webbs after Ramses has done a drill right after a fire and maybe caused the death of one of the sailors. And there's a really weird sequence where he's, like, working out or something. For some reason, they have boxing gloves and, like, a bunch of, like, classic gym stuff on the submarine. But then he goes to talk to Webbs and it's like noticeably different, that he's not as stoic, he's much more casual, that he's just talking to his buddy about the thing that's frustrating to him. And so I think it's unfortunate we don't get any more scenes like that, because pretty much from then to the end of the movie, Hunter is always on, in the sense that Hunter is always 100% stoic and self-assured and positive that he's right, which is fun to watch, but it's not the most interesting thing in the world to watch, for me at least. I love when characters are like, oh, I'm not sure if what I'm doing is right or not, and I'm kind of having to grow over the course of the film, which is not, you know, the point of this movie, but, you know, tough for the movie that that's what I wanted it to do.
Well, I absolutely agree, actually. I think I've said before that, in my opinion, doubt is the most important element of a character's journey, of like a, of the best characters' journeys.
Mm-hmm.
I think we talked about that in The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And about how Batman's doubt about his decisions is so much of what makes that movie compelling. And I think you're right. I think that this movie is kind of, it's sort of leaving some stuff on the table in its, what's the phrase? Like leaving points on the board or something?
Oh shoot. I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure what it is.
Well, you get the point. It's sacrificing some nuance and some depth. Submarine pun right there.
Wow, good one, Elliot.
Thanks. It always happens unintentionally.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it has to. I don't think that this is an example of a movie where that kind of thing would just overcomplicate stuff. I can see this movie being all that it is and more with the addition of a more substantive arc for Hunter.
Hmm.
Which I'm also going to take this opportunity to shift into one of my negatives, which is very much related. And that's that while Gene Hackman, I think, does a great job, and he's a very intimidating and effective antagonist, I think, but also I feel like the movie sometimes artificially undercuts his position. And it's another example of a sacrifice of nuance that I never really got the sense that the movie... Well, we said this in the beginning. I never really got the sense that the movie was really building towards a revelation that Ramses was right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that comes down to like meta-textual stuff or just the way that he's presented, right? Angry, selfish sometimes, arrogant to a certain extent. I think that those classically antagonistic characteristics sort of marked him in my mind as the antagonist. And in a movie like this, the antagonist is never going to be right. They're never going to win. And especially towards the end of the movie, when he's threatening to shoot some random sailor in order to get Webbs to do the thing, I was like, this feels... I just don't need this, right? In order to... I don't think that the tension needs it. I don't think that the movie's construction of the conflict needs it. The movie is basically sort of... It's very similar to what Black Panther does. One of Black Panther's big problems, in my view, is that it is approaching like the territory of some uncomfortable questions, but ultimately plays it safe by having the antagonist do things that are instantly recognizable as things that only an antagonist who is in the wrong would do, right?
Mm-hmm.
That I feel like if Ramsey's character was leveraging more of his sense of duty, his sense, if there was like a sense that he was acting out of like a real concern for his nation, right? That the stakes are that if Hunter is wrong and they are truly supposed to be going forward with their attack and they're not doing it, then the separatists will have the chance to launch an attack on the American homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we got the sense that that was more his concern rather than what is more, what feels a little bit more to me, at least, like just his own arrogant dislike of being questioned.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the movie would be that much more effective. Again, not like it's not effective right now, but it is just, it just, it, it, there's some missed potential there.
Yeah. It kind of, the movie that kind of jumped to my mind as like, this is an example of what we're talking about done really, really well is like Prisoners. That
absolutely,
the, both the protagonists in Prisoners do questionable things or are implied to have done questionable things. And then there's a real, it's dealing with a very, very thorny moral question. It's difficult to come down really harshly on the protagonists because a lot of the things they do are things that are believable, and it's compelling to watch them go and do these things that are, you know, morally wrong, but their motivation makes a lot of sense. And I just don't ever get that sense with Ramses, where I'm, yeah, exactly like you said, it feels more like he's just angry that someone is saying no than he's like 100% convinced. And I think the best scene, like when the three guys go to try and convince Webbs to join them, like James Gandolfini and then Zimmerman, I think, is one of the other guys. I don't remember the names of these other people. But when they're trying to convince Webbs, like, these are the arguments that I would believe that, like, make the moral question of what's happening convincing. Exactly what you said, Elliot, right? Like, think of your family. If we don't fire first, they're going to fire at, you know, America, and they could hit where your family lives, or they could hit people you know. And like, those are arguments that I'm like, yeah, that's a tough moral quandary of, you know, if you really think that you could be, if there's a hint that you could be wrong, then you should really be, right, studiously, carefully looking at this question. And the movie has seemingly no interest in examining this question. And I think it's also frustrating because at the end of the movie, there's an epilogue sequence, and there's not even a sense where Ramses is like, dang, that was like, yikes, that could have been bad. Ramses is still like super smug and, you know, trying to be so cool. And I'm like, bro, you almost started World War III. Like, you were, you, firstly, you almost shot, like, an innocent person for no reason. And then you were about to, like, nuke Russia. That's super bad. But again, the movie is focused on, you know, the things that it does well. And it does those things well. But this isn't, like, Mad Max Fury Road, where it's doing it so well that I'm like, I have no interest in anything else, especially when the movie keeps presenting that something else to me, keeps presenting me with moral quandaries and characters making difficult decisions, and then the movie is seemingly more concerned with how to, you know, make an exciting set piece, which it does, but I think it would be better if it had other stuff in it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that actually the comparison to Prisoners is very good, because I distinctly remember the first time I watched Prisoners, and of course I didn't know the answers to all of I didn't know what was coming.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember there coming a moment where I was thinking, like, why does Alex not just tell him? And being more concerned about Hugh Jackman's character, whose name I've, of course, forgotten, than I was about Alex. And, well, not more concerned, but just like a split concern of thinking like, oh, man, this is rough. But like, yes, like I can absolutely see this. It's like the ending of The Last of Us, where I'm like, dude, that is so tough, but that is 100% believable.
Yeah.
And I never really got that sense with Ramses. A sense of like desperation, the same kind of desperation that bolsters Hunter's cause and is the trademark of, like, again, that's how movies show us who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, yeah. Right? And I think that a little bit more ambiguity would have served the movie well. But again, I just love repeating myself. I think that the movie already works as is, but I see the potential in it. I see the potential for true greatness. That sadly, it's just not quite there.
Yeah. I just have a couple of other kind of notes on the technical aspects of the movie. For one, I had to look up when this movie came out because so many of the scenes, I was like, they're doing the same exact tricks as Hunt for the Red October. So who's ripping who off here? And I looked, this movie is ripping off Hunt for Red October. Hunt for Red October came out 5 years beforehand, which I was relieved. I was like, I would hate to know that a movie I've always treasured is cribbing from another film. That would be difficult for me. There's also a ton of Dutch angles in this movie. I think I've said on the record, I'm not a huge Dutch angle fan. And you could say, you can send me an email like, oh, it's because the submarine is tilted. That's stupid. And also, if the submarine is as tilted as the camera, there's no way these characters are walking around as easily as they're depicted. If it's really that tilted, these people should be like crawling everywhere. It's ridiculous.
They're also, all blessed with calves of steel.
I guess. They're all wearing, like, track cleats or something.
Yeah.
My other note, I think the music for this is decent. Hans Zimmer is doing the score. But there are a couple moments, and I'd love to, like, see someone do an analysis of this. Because I swear, Hans Zimmer did, like, pseudo Pirates of the Caribbean themes for a decade leading up to the release of Pirates of the Caribbean. Because there's a passage in this movie score that does the Pirates of the Caribbean thing, or very nearly does the dun 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 dun, whatever the Pirates of the Caribbean theme is. I can't sing it from the top of my head. But, like, he does the same thing in Gladiator, that Gladiator has parts of the score where you're like, this is just Pirates of the Caribbean. It's a good, like, it's a good, upbeat, exciting, dramatic theme, but it was just crazy to me that I saw Hans Zimmer at the beginning. I'm like, that's crazy. He did the score for this, and then that part started playing, and I was like, oh, yeah, duh, he did the part for this.
Yeah, dude. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that was, I was just going to say those are my kind of final technical notes that I had.
Oh, yeah. Hans Zimmer frustrates me so much because in the moments where he's not in his usual environs, like in Inception or Interstellar or Dune, like he proves that he has the talent to make something unique and something that I listen to casually. But yeah, when he's on the blockbuster train, he just sort of puts it in neutral and brings out Old Reliable, which sure. It's unfortunate. But yeah, just last few notes from me. I really like the production design of this. I have no way of knowing if this is actually what a nuclear submarine looks like, but it convinced me. So yeah, it did have a sense of verisimilitude. Magellan's at the Movies' favorite word, verisimilitude.
Not true.
I thought that the editing and the cinematography were both very good, just in terms of they both have that same, like, just constantly driving energy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I noted that even in the submarine fights, which of course is another thing that this movie and Hunt for Red October shares, even in that, I feel like this movie's submarine fight was more actionized than Hunt for Red October's, which was more of this like plodding, unwieldy. It's more like what an actual submarine fight would be like, because you're trying to maneuver several thousand tons of metal in the shape of a cigar, at like thousands of feet under sea level. It's not going to be very fast, but it's not fast in Crimson Tide, but it is noticeably more energetic, which is less realistic. But remember, realism is not enough when it comes to films. And in this case, I'm more than willing to forgive it, because I thought the submarine fight was actually pretty exciting. And yeah, when Hunter scores the hit and everyone's cheering, I was right there with him. I was like, yeah, let's go. We did it. So, I think we're about ready to rate this son of a gun.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Oh, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. I don't have a ton to add. I feel like we've really neatly summarized a lot of the things that I feel about this movie. It's meat and potatoes, and so its cap for how good it can be is a certain level, and it doesn't aspire to go above that level, which isn't like a terrible thing, but it's reflected in the score here. I think this is like a classic. And I think I've said this for another movie that I would agree, I feel very similarly about, that it's a classic, like, 7.3, 7.4 out of 10 movie. It's not, like, the upper echelons of fantastic action cinema, but it's a good movie. If someone, I love this metric so much. Elliot doesn't like it as much. But, you know, if I was hanging out with some people and they were like, hey, do you want to watch Crimson Tide? I'm like, definitely. That sounds like a great idea. Let's order some Pizza Hut, crack open some brewskis, and watch Crimson Tide.
All right. Nathan loves cracking open brewskis. I'm a little bit higher than you, but not too much. I think this movie's really good, really entertaining. Yeah, I'm not going to repeat myself any longer. I'm going to give this movie it's tough. This is one of those movies where I wish my ranking system had the same flexibility that Nathan does. Because it's between a B+ and an A-. I'm going to give it a B+.
Okay. Elliot, before I do my recommendation, I just have to ask, because I am genuinely curious, do you get the reference in the title of this film?
Crimson Tide.
Oh, I take that as a no. The Alabama college football team is the Alabama Crimson Tide.
Fascinating.
That's why they say at the beginning, they say Roll Tide. That's what Alabama fans say. Yeah. I was just wondering if you... I know you're not a huge sports guy, so I was like, I wonder if Elliot gets the reference.
I figured it was just, right, the warlike imagery of blood in the water.
I think it's that and Alabama.
Okay. Why don't you make a recommendation, Nathan?
All right. Well, my recommendation is, and this is just because this is the things I was thinking about as I watched the movie, that this movie is about, you know, nuclear war, the prospect.
Did you say nuclear?
Whatever. The prospect of mutually assured destruction. And so I went to, I'd say, the classic mutually assured destruction film, and that's going to be Stanley Kubrick's Doctor Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. This is a fantastic movie. I'm a huge Stanley Kubrick guy, and he just balls out on this film. It's so funny. It is so well made. It is so interesting to watch. Again, it's a farce about nuclear holocaust, and so it is constantly teasing out. Elliot, there's no right way to pronounce nuclear.
That is wrong. That is a factual misstatement.
But anyway, the movie is constantly poking fun and kind of teasing out these ideas that, you know, the Cold War is kind of fundamentally ridiculous in the sense that it's based on people being more emotional than it is people being logical and dealing with problems in a way that's going to resolve them well. It is a genuinely really funny movie. The sequence at the end when the general is, like, describing the plane and just gets more and more fired up by the end, and it's a really serious thing that cracks me up every time I see it. So I'm gonna recommend that. I'm also gonna throw out here again, it's not my main recommendation because I did it for Red October, but if you're looking for more submarine movies, please watch Das Boot or The Boat. It's a German film about a World War II German U-boat, and it is so fantastic. I think there's like an extended version that's like 6 hours long. So if you're like a middle-aged dad who loves submarine movies, watch Das Boot, please.
All right. Nuclear is pronounced nuclear.
Whatever.
There is no ambiguity on this question. Yeah, dude. Thank goodness. Thank goodness we've moved past all that. Nuclear saber rattling. It's a thing of the past. No one's really interested in that anymore. I mean, gosh, what a relief.
All right, Elliot. Let's stick to what we do. We review movies. Give a recommendation.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I also really enjoy Dr. Strangelove. I'm not 100% sure that there's a whole lot of connective tissue between that movie and Crimson Tide, but that's all right. My recommendation is one that Nathan has already done before, actually, but it doesn't count when it's him, so I get to do it this time. That's going to be 10 Cloverfield Lane. This movie is more back towards the Hunt for Red October end of the spectrum in terms of it's a more like complex, layered thriller. There's more like dynamics that you need to be aware of and keep track of. But this is a movie about a young woman who gets into a car crash and wakes up in a bunker with two other people, one normal guy and one possibly insane guy, who claim that the world has been attacked by aliens or something. And it operates on a very similar is it or is it not question to Crimson Tide. The question of what happened, the true intentions of Walter, isn't it the name of the
John Goodman's character? Wow, good job, yeah.
Yeah, there's so much about this movie that's tense, and if you're of a nervous disposition, I would recommend watching this movie maybe with a friend, maybe in the afternoon rather than the evening, because it's a nerve shredder, people. Or at least it was to me. Maybe you're out there saying like, oh man, what a baby. But what can I say? It's true. But yeah, it operates on that similar. It generates tension through similar questions and it also has that same just like base pleasure of watching characters try to outsmart each other and try to come up with creative solutions to difficult problems. So get on over to your nearest Blockbuster Video, rent it, get it watched.
Yeah. I second that recommendation. I love 10 Cloverfield Lane. I think that is such a fantastic movie. Every time I see someone dissing it for stupid reasons, I get a little angry, but
start seeing a Crimson Tide.
Yeah, I start seeing the Alabama college football team.
Exactly. Well, as the Alabama college football team knows, life is hard and full of disappointments.
Dude, so
I don't actually know if that joke works.
Actually, that joke works really well. I think Alabama had the worst college football seasons in their program's history. Like
fantastic.
A historically bad year for Alabama football.
Well, bad for them, good for my joke.
All right, well, thank you so much for listening. We apologize if you were really looking forward to the 80s episode. It's going to be coming next week, and all the better for the extra time that we've dedicated to it. You're not even going to believe how much better it is than if we had recorded it this week. It's going to be crazy. And there's no way you could prove that I'm wrong because we didn't record it this week. But send us an email if you have seen Crimson Tide and you love the movie and you disagree with something we said. If you, this is going to be your last chance. If you have an 80s movie that you're desperate for us to talk about and want to make sure that we've watched as we head into this final week, send us an email. Let us know.
If you're angry about the delay, go ahead and send us a death threat. Maybe send us, call us a few names.
We would love to get hate mail. We would love any type of mail that we could get.
Just correspondence, please.
But anyway, thank you so much for listening. We're going to be back next week with that brand new episode. And we hope you have a great week.